potential impact on your revenues. And I guess my first question is to what extent you folks are trying to encourage greater consistency in terms of follow-up on forfeiture if that takes place. And I guess the second somewhat related issue, maybe this has been addressed earlier, is do we have any case law or any guidance for the courts in terms of exercising the good cause that's described on line 23 in existing law in terms of the court's discretion to forgive or to remit portions of the amount that may be forfeited?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Springer, addressing the second question first, I'm not aware of any case law that has interpreted the application of that phrase in this context. As far as the first question, under existing law, we have found that the district attorneys simply are not pursuing these matters. I'm aware of only one county, Yamhill County, where it's done absolutely consistently, and I think some other counties do it on a more sporadic basis, and Washington may well be one of them. But part of the motivation for the bill was simply to acknowledge the reality that these aren't getting enforced through the existing process available to the district attorney's office, and their argument is workload, and there are more important cases to pursue. And so this would give us an option to the existing statute, which sort of puts the ball in their court as far as enforcement.
I guess a follow-up question would be, do we have any indication that if I understand your position, that this is going to put the ball in the DA's court? That
no, Mr. Representative Springer, I misspoke myself once again. Right now, they need to initiate the enforcement in these, right, in these types of cases. It's not happening. This gives us an option which takes that initiation away from them, and I think allows us to bypass current step, which is to get the DAs to commit to handle these kinds of matters. This allows the court to order the forfeitures on an entire amount within 30 days after the person has not appeared under the conditions of release. It really relieves the district attorneys of what is a mandatory responsibility, but which isn't being performed.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that clarification.
Thank you. Further questions? Mr. Linden? It would appear that there are no objections to the bill as written. Is there a motion to send this to the full committee? Representative Phillips.
I would move House Bill 2180 with a due pass recommendation to the full committee.
Representative Phillips moves to send House Bill 2180 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? If not, clerk, call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Okay. House Bill 2182, relating to plea discussions in criminal cases. I think we had somebody in. Mr. Linden.
Mr. Chairman, at the first hearing on House Bill 2182, I indicated that we would be offering an amendment, which I think you now have in front of you. 2182 generally clarifies that judges can participate in plea discussions in criminal cases. The amendment that we're offering would allow that upon the agreement of the trial judge and the presiding judge, the parties could agree to allow the judge before whom the plea discussions took place to proceed with the actual plea process with the same judge. And the way that would work would be if Judge A was the judge who had dealt with the parties during the plea negotiation discussions, if the parties agree, that same judge could actually take the plea in the given case. The original language of the bill would not have allowed that or made it somewhat unclear. Our intent, and I think you're going to hear some testimony about the wisdom of this, our intent is to encourage judge participation in plea negotiations because we think it's one method of encouraging faster pleas in cases where there's going to be a plea in any event, and also to remove some ambiguity in existing law about whether or not judges can properly do that. there is language in the bill relating to involvement of the presiding judges. This is in there because in recognition that in many of our multi-judge counties, the presiding judges have taken on a more central administrative role, and they can direct judges, other judges within the court, to do certain things, both in civil and criminal proceedings. So, again, if I can just leave you with the one thought, we think this will encourage participation in the plea negotiation process, which we think, in the long run, will save the system some time and money, because it will encourage things to happen sooner rather than later.
Thank you, Mr. Linden. Stephen Jacobson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Just, did you put your name on again for the record?
Steve Jacobson, appearing. I represent the Metropolitan Public Defender's Office. I have some background information which we have attempted to copy for the committee. It's a little bit mixed up at the moment. These are about 10 or so copies, of two each, done like that. And these are proposed amendment to that. Generally, I am in philosophical support of basically what Mr. Linden is proposing, in that there's right now a law which says the trial judge shall not participate in plea discussions, and everybody who's involved in the system knows that to more or less formal degrees, in depending on where you practice, the trial judges do become involved in plea discussions, negotiations, either during the discussion sometimes or by being presented with the results of a discussion and becoming involved at that point. And it's not something that the defense bar or the district attorney's office are here. I think you will not hear any of them oppose some involvement. The problem I have with this particular formulation has to do with the language and the wisdom of having any kind of language like this. What I've provided for the committee is some background on the history of why we have the statute the way we have it. There's a simply two pages coming copied out of the proposed criminal procedure code that was adopted in 1973 in Oregon, which with one amendment, I think, is the statute that is now in effect in Oregon. That's the two-page mimeograph copy that you've been provided with. This was taken word for word from the ABA standards as they existed at that time. And generally, the trial judge was prohibited from participating in plea discussions. On the other hand, the following sections of the statute allowed the judge to become involved with a proposed or tentative plea agreement. And then if the judge wanted to, the judge could tentatively agree that he would sentence under the agreement, but in no way would the judge be bound. The judge would form their own independent judgment about what an appropriate sentence was after the judge received all the information. The ABA standards have changed since that time, and so I guess Oregon is trailing the pack at this point, and we're seeing the problem in terms of what's been proposed to you as House Bill 2182. Everybody knows that there's a little bit more than that that does go on and that perhaps should go on. The standard as it now exists, as far as the ABA standard, I presented to you along with its commentary. And the commentary beginning on page 82 talks about the historical development of the standard from where it used to be an absolute prohibition against participating in plea negotiations to where it now stands. The standard sets out a number of criteria for a judge potentially to follow to become involved in plea discussions. The standards include provisions that the judge may encourage plea discussions, may act as a moderator during plea discussions, and generally sets out what kind of judicial behavior is acceptable versus unacceptable, and what kind of direction can be given the parties, with explicit directions that the judge not be involved in any way that would look like it was coercing a guilty plea in a case. I mean, that's the main concern, is that when you involve the judiciary in plea negotiations, potentially you're creating a problem that's going to have to come out in the wash later. And that is, if the judge is seen, the judge who's the objective party in a criminal case, if the judge is seen as taking a side, particularly with regard to encouraging a plea by his action or by his advice to the defendant or the defense counsel, you may be creating a coerced plea, which will be constitutionally infirm, which later on down the line is going to be subject to attack. So the ABA standards set out specifically in, I think it's standard F, that the judge should never, through word or demeanor, either directly or indirectly, communicate to the defendant or defense counsel that a plea agreement should be accepted or that a guilty plea should be entered. That's one example of the kind of direction that perhaps the legislature could undertake to give. I'm not proposing at this point that we simply codify the ABA standards. I'm not sure that that's necessary. I'm not sure that I agree with every particular thing in here or that anybody on the committee would. The proposed language that House Bill 2182 has seems to me to create more problems than it solves. In the amendment that I've offered as, again, not necessarily, I'm not necessarily saying it's the best way to handle this, but an amendment that would accomplish what Mr. Linden is talking about and yet not bind the hands of the judiciary by saying it must happen in a certain way would be to simply remove present subsection 1 of ORS 135.432 that now says the trial judge shall not participate in plea discussions. If that is removed, then you'd have a state of the law where the judge potentially could participate or not, and nobody would exactly know what standards we're talking about, but we wouldn't have the problems that I see by adopting the language that the House bill does. Those problems are that this particular language seems to have been arrived at by the experience of one judge in a rural county where cases get assigned in a certain way. It doesn't make any sense to me, coming from Multnomah County, to say the trial judge may not participate in plea discussions, because that's where it normally happens. In district court, for certain, that a number of cases are assigned to an individual judge, 7-8 cases in a day, and that's on their docket, and there's a lot of informality that goes on in plea discussions that take place in the presence of the judge, if the judge so desires. Despite the statute, some of this goes on. If by removing this language, the judge would be allowed to moderate in plea negotiations that go on at that point, and yet it would be allowed to be the trial judge. The language that's presented, while it might be effective in Klamath County or wherever it's from, would not necessarily be the best way to handle this in other counties. It also appears to allow the judge to participate in plea discussions when the participants don't desire that participation, and I'm not sure of the wisdom of that. The ABA standard sets up a little bit different criteria, saying something about the judge may inquire as to the status of the plea negotiations and may encourage them, but the idea that the judge can somehow participate in plea discussions when neither side wants to seems to be saying something other than what you probably want to say. This is a difficult and kind of thorny area. I've really only been able, I guess, to provide you some background and to point out some dangers with going with the language the way it's written. I think you might be better served by deleting subsection 1, not talk about prohibiting judges from entering into plea negotiations, and allowing the informal procedures as they've sprung up around the state to go on the way they're now going on, without judges having to feel uncomfortable about this particular prohibition being in the statute.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson. I would gather that you prefer not to change statute at all.
I would probably prefer to change the statute with a good deal of some detail with something similar to the ABA standards. That's a pretty long set of statutes to pass and pretty involved, and I think it would really involve some policy choices about how much of that we want to go with. For instance, they say all plea discussions must be on the record and recorded, whereas I know that it's the practice in a lot of places to do a lot of this informally, off the record. So I'm not sure if we want to adopt that for our state. So that would be one variation. On the other hand, some of the other things I think are very good ideas and would aid exactly the kind of thing Mr. Linden's talking about, would aid the resolution of cases more speedily, which the defense bar certainly is in favor of, and everybody should be in favor of.
Is this the way that this is drafted, as I understand it right now, the trial judge still is not allowed to participate in plea discussions, but any other judge that requests both prosecution and the defense, or at the direction of the presiding judge, which then of course gets into that question. And then there's the agreement there that doesn't seem to violate the principle that you're talking about getting the judges actually involved in that specific trial. You're getting the judiciary involved in those, but they're going to be involved in it anyway. So I'm wondering if your objection is so strong that this doesn't seem to violate the standards you're talking about without having read them here, of course. But there's more safeguards built into the standards that you're talking about.
I'm not sure why we should say, if we're going to allow judges in plea bargaining, I'm not sure why we should not allow the trial judge. Why single out one judge? The history of the word trial judge in the statute is not that it applied to the judge who's trying the case and not to other judges. The history, the clear history, is that it applied to all judges. The word trial is in there by mistake. It's not no longer in the ABA standard. They talk about the judge, not the trial judge. So it was meant to mean no judge shall participate. And I don't agree that's appropriate. I think that there's a position that judges in general should be allowed, and I don't think the trial judge should be singled out as not being allowed to participate.
Okay, so you would say that you would amend this to say any judge could participate under those standards, whether it be the trial judge or otherwise. That takes it further than they're talking about here. Thank you.
Right.
Questions? Mr. Jacobson?
I have one.
Mr. Taylor.
Steve, if a trial judge were to participate in plea negotiations and plea negotiations were to break down, then I assume he would have to withdraw from his position as trial judge.
I don't know that that's the case, because I think we're talking about fairly limited involvement in general. Usually what goes on is the judge is a moderator between the sides, if they're involved at all. Usually not indicating specific positions, but trying to see if some middle ground can be reached and providing encouragement in doing that. And if the sides just say, no, we can't agree, I don't see any particular reason, unless something has occurred to prejudice the judge in some way, why the judge couldn't then try the case. I mean, it goes on in counties where masses of trials, that we have this fast-track system that we've gone to in Multnomah County Circuit Court many times. The docket there gets backed up horribly. They send 30 cases to one judge and say, you're going to try these cases back-to-back if you don't resolve them. And some of them get tried back-to-back until they're done. And others, you're sitting around in chambers one by one, go over the cases and see if you can work something out. It's going to be the trial judge, and you're going to go to trial in 10 minutes if you don't resolve it. I mean, that's not exactly a judicial order to enter a plea, but it's a hammer on both sides to see if you can work something out if you can.
Would it be safe to say that some judges encourage people to plea out or to encourage a settlement between the...
I think that happens. I'm not sure if you're a judge how you decide what the line is and when you're stepping over that line. I think it's a real difficult decision. I think that if we're going to legislate in this area, I think it would really be beneficial to the bar, to the bench, to include some kind of guidelines on that. That's why I think the ABA standards are an attempt at that, to identify the judge as a moderator who should not be indicating to defendants that they should plead guilty. Because otherwise, I think that is a danger that if judges enter this fray with the eye toward clearing up their dockets and get involved in putting pressure in that way, that is a danger. And the danger is that the convictions you thereby obtain are not only coerced, but they're later subject to attack.
Isn't there a possible argument that there'd be coercion if the judge says, well, if we don't get a plea, I guess we'll have to try this case right now?
If you're sent out to trial for that day, it's not really coercion. They're just telling you what, in fact, is going to happen. And that is the way the fast-track system has worked.
And if he adds to it, I'm going to be here on the case, too. I've had that happen to me, so.
That is the way that the system occasionally works. I think it would be coercion if they say, if you don't plead guilty, I'm going to sentence, and you get convicted, I'm going to sentence you to the maximum extent of the law. I think that's coercion. For a judge to say something like that. I don't think it's coercion for a DA to do that. That's what plea bargaining is, sure. And that's who really the other side is in plea bargaining. Really, the two sides are the defendant and the district attorney. The district attorney may say, I will recommend the maximum if you don't plead guilty. And there's nothing unethical about that. That's the side that holds the power in plea negotiation, not the judge.
But don't you think some bright metropolitan defender may someday make the argument that a judge who says that if we don't have some type of an agreement, this case is going to be tried today and I'm going to hear it, is going to make an argument that there is an implied threat there?
I'm just not sure that there'd be any substance to the argument that you're thinking of if, in fact, you were scheduled for trial that day and you're about to go to trial. And he's just saying, if you don't plead, this will go to trial in front of me.
I knew I took it as a threat.
Uh-huh. Well, it is a threat that you'll go to trial. It's not a threat that something specific is going to happen to you as a result.
Well, I think we went beyond. I took it as a threat that if he heard it and if Johnson was found guilty, it would be a serious sentence imposed upon him.
Well, that's not something that should be happening. And
okay. Any further questions, Mr. Jacobson? Thank you very much. What's the wishes here on this? We've been presented with a significant number of concepts that we've heard since we had the first hearing on this. Do you want to hold this over and let everybody kind of absorb some of these things and schedule this for a second work session?
Definitely.
I think we'd do that. All right, we'll hold this one over. Mr. Springer?
My recollection is, and maybe this was covered earlier, is that I think Circuit Judge Ted Abrams from the Klamath County area has been doing some of the work in this area, and I would hope that Mr. Jacobson and Mr. or Judge Abrams would have a chance to confer further.
I don't understand.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We'll move into a... Was there anyone else who wished to be heard on House Bill 2182? I don't think. Okay, House Bill 2186, regarding the cost of producing evidence, Mr. Linden. Got to get your nameplate out here.
For the record, Bill Linden, State Court Administrator. House Bill 2186 relates to witness fees in criminal proceedings, and with the amendments that were distributed, I think last Friday, perhaps you're just seeing them today, would extend the provisions of this bill to cover juvenile and mental proceedings as well.
Excuse me, does everyone have that?
I don't think I do.
The amendments, they're about two or three pages, I think. Fairly extensive. Sorry, Mr. Lee.
The amendments, as I mentioned, would reconcile the language relating to witnesses in the juvenile and mental hearings to the proposed language of 2186 in the criminal area. In recognition of the fact that we're dealing with the same kinds of confusing statutes presently in these areas as we are in the criminal law area, the last time that there was the first hearing on this bill, there were a couple of specific questions that came up that I wanted to quickly address if I could. In Section 2, the existing language, line 14, existing language relating to how many witnesses a defendant is entitled to have subpoenas issued for, that language is deleted there. It is, however, retained in ORS 136570, and that was one of the questions I think Representative Burton had, was it getting rid of that language completely? And it is retained elsewhere in statute. Also in that same section too, in line 18, and I spoke with counsel about this earlier today, the reference to ORS 136602 should be deleted because it relates solely to prosecution witnesses and grand jury witnesses, and the thrust of this section has to do with the criminal defendant and the witness issues related to them. I'd be happy to try and answer any questions on the main bill or the amendments.
Would you, for me, just very quickly go over those? Well, go over the amendments, the remaining amendments okay. there in the, section two.
Mr. Chairman, we're suggesting.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Mr. Phillips.
Mr. Linden, as you go over them, have you done a fiscal impact on these two? Or maybe if you have, you could delineate what these changes cost, if anything.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, the first suggestion is to amend ORS Chapter 419 to add the following language: responsibility for the payment of the cost of service of summons or other process on any party and for the payment of travel expenses so authorized shall be borne by the party initiating the action in the juvenile court. What this basically would do, first of all, it amends a statute that hasn't been touched since 1977 before the state takeover and assumption of indigent defense costs. And this would simply clarify that the responsibility for payment relates back to the party who's initiating the action, the resulting in the payment. As far as this particular aspect of the bill, I don't believe we anticipate any fiscal impact on the Indigent Defense Fund. We're also suggesting in Chapter 419.
Excuse me. No savings either?
I don't believe so, because what we've tried to do with the bill and the amendments is to pull together confusing and language that's tossed about among the statutes, but also it basically reinforces what the status quo is in terms of how parties are paying. We've taken the position that the Judicial Department won't pay for anything that isn't expressly authorized by statute, but we basically have, in this bill, tried to keep it absolutely consistent with the way things are actually getting paid right now. The second suggestion in Chapter 419 is the language on the first page there, and basically this relates to the juvenile statutes, and it outlines who's responsible for the payment of these fees in juvenile cases. Even though these juvenile proceedings technically are not criminal proceedings, we've had them, the payment provisions track what they are in the criminal law, in part of the main bill. And again, we think this clarifies the scheme which is presently in place, and basically coming back to the principle that the party on whose behalf the witness is being subpoenaed is the one who bears the cost of the expense. The proposed amendments to ORS Chapter 426 relate to mental health proceedings, and these are proceedings involving allegedly mentally ill persons, and current law doesn't really lay out who's responsible for what within that process. These amendments make them consistent again with the juvenile and the criminal. Again, they're keyed to the principle that if whoever the party is who's initiating the expense, they're responsible for the payment of it. The amendments to Chapter 427 involve proceedings with allegedly mentally retarded persons. Again, present law doesn't address who's responsible for what, and these statutes make it consistent with the juvenile and criminal area and go back to that same principle.
Thank you. Are there questions on either the amendments or generally? Okay, the chair entertained a motion to adopt the proposed amendments to House Bill 2186 as proposed by Mr. Linden.
Could I ask a question prior to that?
Oh, certainly. You may ask a question prior to that.
Do you have any other witnesses signed up to testify?
No, I don't believe there is. There's no one. Unless there's anyone here. Mr. Yes, we do. We have someone up here. Well, then perhaps we'll wait on that motion. And Mr. Jacobson, would you like to comment?
After, Mr. Chairman, Steve Jacobson from the Metropolitan Public Defender's Office. After discussing this bill with Mr. Linden before the hearing, I had what I thought was my objection satisfied. Now I'm having difficulty in Section 2 with what Mr. Linden addressed at the beginning of his testimony today, with subpoenas for up to 10 witnesses and who bears the cost of that. My understanding is that the intent of the bill is to allow subpoenas for up to 10 witnesses for both the defense and the state without charging the defendant. If that's correct, I'm still concerned that this actual bill, the way it reads, doesn't accomplish that.
Is that correct?
That is correct. And the I think maybe where the confusion here is that in reading the language, you have to recognize that if it's an indigent defendant, the state is going to be absorbing the additional cost of producing witnesses, for example, in excess of the 10 that are authorized in the other ORS section. We didn't want to use the term indigent because not every defendant is indigent, but I think it never entered into our thinking that we were going to be, that we wouldn't be making that distinction. Obviously, the extraordinary expenses that indigent...